RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Margaret Cho, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio.
What up, though? This is Invincible from Detroit to Oakland. Always listening to Hard Knock Radio. News, views, and hip-hop. Yeah.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system. Stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. You know, it was just the other day that we saw an article that came out that talked about the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan. Many people consider it one of the earliest terrorist groups in the United States. Had been aggressively recruiting people, and many are returning home from having been recruited and serving time in the military, and it raised questions as to what that would mean. We wanted to kind of go back into time because for some people this is like something new and a cause for alarm, but apparently this has been going on for quite a while. And about 30 years ago, the gentleman on the phone line with us, who's no stranger to our airwaves, actually infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan when he was a police officer in Colorado Springs. Doesn't sound too unusual, except this particular officer, or former officer, is black. His skin is chocolate, and he has written a book called Black Klansmen that talks about that, and I wanted to get him on the line to, first of all, share some insights about his book and see if we should be concerned about some of these revelations that are coming up today. So, on the phone line with us is Sergeant Ron Stallworth. How you doing, sir?
How you doing, Davey?
Good, good. So, you know, we had you on a couple of times, and you talked briefly about you joining the Klan and what that was like and how you were able to do it, and now you finally wrote a book about it. Let's talk a little bit about this, because in the book you go into a lot of details and you bring to light a number of things that we should all be paying attention to, in particular the formation of militias and what that means, et cetera, et cetera. So let's talk about Black Klansmen, what this is about, and how you as a former peace officer were able to do what, you know, has been immortalized in a Dave Chappelle skit. Maybe he knew about your operation and maybe he didn't. But let's talk a little bit about it.
Well, I don't think Dave Chappelle knew about my operation. In fact, I know he didn't. It's just ironic that he came up with his comedy skit and it paralleled what I had done. At the time Chappelle did his skit, it paralleled what I had done about 25 years earlier. Except mine was reality, his was comedy.
Right.
As I've told your listeners on previous occasions, in 1978, the Ku Klux Klan, under the auspices of David Duke, the Grand Wizard at the time, of the most notable Klan faction down in New Orleans, they were forming a chapter in Colorado Springs where I was a police detective. I was the youngest detective in the history of the Colorado Springs Police Department and the first black detective in the history of that department at the age of 22. At the time this event took place in 1978, I was 25 years old. And
You know, coming off the heels of the Black Power movements and everything. So there's still a lot of energy and a lot of conscious raising in terms of, you know, us as a people coming together, et cetera, et cetera.
There was still a lot of that. There was still a little bit of tension in the air in terms of the police community. There was still a little bit of tension in terms of the police community as to the nature of what was going on within the black community. And so we were a little bit, we meaning the police community, we were a little bit on edge in terms of events and goings on within the black community. But my job was to stay on top of so-called subversive groups. And as you pointed out in your introduction, the Ku Klux Klan is and has been designated a domestic terrorist group throughout its long history. And that history, I might add, goes back to 1869. They came to strong prominence during the height of the civil rights movement in the early days, back in the 1950s and 60s, in particular.
Right.
And my job was to stay on top of groups like this, and so I was concerned, as an intelligence detective with the department, my job was to stay on top of groups like this. And so when I saw that the Ku Klux Klan had put an advertisement in the classified ad section of one of our newspapers, it simply said, Ku Klux Klan, for information, there was a P.O. box address. I answered the address. It was a fluke. I didn't think much would come of it. But I answered the address pretending to be a white racist like they were. And when I say pretending, I used all the buzzwords of hate that they like to use, referring to blacks. For your listening audience, I'll use the term N-word. I used the N-word. I used references, derogatory references to Asians, to Mexicans, to Jewish citizens. You pick the ethnic group I use derogatory terms for. And I sent this letter off to them, and I forgot about it. I made a crucial mistake in that I identified myself by my real name instead of using the undercover names that I went by for undercover purposes. I had two different names, and I mistakenly used my real name, Ron Stallworth, which was dumb of me, but I had a brain cramp that day. And
right.
I sent the letter off and forgot about it. And I also gave the undercover phone line that we used to communicate with people. It was an untraceable line at that time in history. And within about a week, I get a phone call at the line, and it's the local Klan organizer. That's how he identifies himself. In my book, he's identified as Ken O'Dell. That's his real name. He was a sergeant in the U.S. Army, stationed at Fort Carson, Colorado, just outside of Colorado Springs. And Ken O'Dell told me he was a local organizer. He said he was recruiting new members for the Klan. He got my letter, and he was interested in what I had to say and thought I'd make a good Klansman. And he wanted to know further why I wanted to join. So I took it further and used more buzzwords of hate. I told him my sister, remember, he thought I was white, I told him my sister was dating a N-word person, And every time he put his filthy black hands in her pure white body, it made me sick to my stomach. And I wanted to do something about that type of thing and to prevent it from happening in the future for future generations of white kids. Right. His response was, "You're just the kind of person we're looking for. When can we meet?" And at that point,
were you surprised that it was somebody from the Army? You know, here, especially because when we were looking back at the Civil Rights era, the Army was, you know, used to help integrate. And of course, I guess by the time you're doing that, the Army was also used to quell some of the rebellions that went on in the cities after the death of King and others. But with that said, you know, one would think that there would be more of a selection process as to who would get in. But this was a sergeant in the U.S. Army.
I wasn't surprised in the sense that I wasn't expecting anything in particular. I wasn't expecting the Army. I wasn't expecting anybody. So the fact that it turned out to be a GI did not really surprise me, because I had no expectations of anything. When I found out it was a soldier, I perked up, because the fact that there was Klansmen involved in the Army, that made me perk up just a little bit more. And it aroused my interest just a little bit more. So at that point in time, I became even more interested in what I realized this was not a fluke, that this had some legs to it, and I was going to run with it as far as I could. Again, the Ku Klux Klan is a domestic terrorist group. Now I find out that I got a GI involved in the Klan. The GI, soldiers, military personnel, they take oaths when they join the service. They take oaths to uphold the Constitution of the United States, to protect, defend the flag and our country. So now I'm extremely concerned and interested in what's going on.
Now, in the book, you talk about that while you were interested, that your immediate supervisor wasn't, and you had to go over their head. And even at the conclusion of your operation, you talk about how they wanted to, like, you know, get rid of all those files. What was that about? You know, with this particular sergeant, was it concern that, you know, that you were investigating the Klan, or was it just a personality thing, or what was the story behind that?
Yeah, it wasn't my immediate supervisor. It was the lieutenant in charge of the narcotics division and his sergeant, both of whom I had worked for a year earlier, and who had we had had a falling out, a personality clash. At that point in time, they had kicked me out of narcotics a year earlier, and I had gotten back into the detective division. They had kicked me out of narcotics, put me back in uniform, which they knew I didn't want to be in, and I had managed to get myself back into the detective division in the intelligence section, and they didn't like that. And when I had to meet this Klansman, we had a phone conversation. I set up a meeting with him. Obviously, being black, I couldn't meet him, so I had to have a white person pose as me. And I described the white officer who matched my height, my description in the book. He's referred to as Chuck.
Right.
I had to have somebody pose as me for the meeting. And that's how we pulled this investigation off. I did most of the talking on the phone, probably 90% of it on the phone. And when it came time for face-to-face meetings, I would send Chuck in posing as me.
They didn't pick up on the difference in voices or anything like that, or speech patterns, anything like that?
During the entire 7 months of the undercover phase of this investigation, I was only challenged once regarding the difference in my voice versus Chuck. Chuck had gone to a meeting that I had set up at the house of Ken, and he left the meeting, and when he returned, Chuck, being a narcotics officer, had drug deals he had to go deal with. And when he left the meeting to go do his regular duty work, I had something that I wanted to discuss further with Ken. So I waited about a half hour. Then I picked the phone up and called Ken at home. And during the course of the conversation, Ken said, "Your voice sounds funny. What's the matter? You don't sound like yourself." So I coughed and I pretended like I had a sinus infection, and He said, oh, I get those all the time. He said, here's what you need to do to fix that. And he proceeded to prescribe a remedy for me. And that's the only time I was ever challenged regarding the difference in my voice versus Chuck's.
Right.
And the key to that was that he was so convinced of my undercover identity based on the conversations I had been having with him. He was so secure in who I had pretended to be that the fact that he now was suspicious of me in that brief moment, he was not going to let his suspicions override the confidence he had already laid on me. I had him hooked, and even his own suspicions weren't going to be aroused.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with former police sergeant Ron Stallworth about his book Black Klansman. He's talking about full details of an historic undercover operation that he did, where he was able to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan and what it took and what was going on. In the book, you talk about some very prominent people at that particular time who were members of the Klan. You talk about a fireman. You also talk about this posse that was really a peacetime posse, but actually a militia group, and their whole situation and them merging with the Ku Klux Klan. I found that to be pretty interesting. Also, what you lay out in the book, which I think people would find fascinating, is how widespread and how far into public life the Klan was. I'm talking about government public life. When you were doing research, you were talking about that they were senators and governors and mayors of all these cities. So this was an organization, terrorist or not, had strong holds in society for very long periods of time. So let's talk about some of these prominent people, including the fireman, who was pretty open that he was a Klansman.
Well, the fireman, his name was Fred Wilkins. Fred was a fireman in Lakewood, Colorado. Lakewood is a suburb of Denver. He was a well-known individual. He was in the press constantly preaching his Klan nonsense, and he was a pain in the butt, so to speak, for Lakewood city officials. But they could do nothing about it because he had a very clean record in terms of his civil service job as a fireman. He was exemplary as a fireman, and therefore all they could do was chastise him verbally, but they could do nothing about him in terms of his Klan activities, and that was the extent of that. But Fred was the Grand Dragon, which is the state leader for the Colorado Ku Klux Klan. I held conversations with Fred on the phone quite a bit. He even asked me to be his public relations spokesperson, which I never did, but he asked me to set up public relations meetings with the media in Colorado Springs. He came to trust me and trust my judgment. Again, I had him hooked on the phone with my undercover role, along with the local organizer, Ken O'Dell. But Fred was an interesting individual. You mentioned the posse, peacetime posse. The Posse Comitatus was not a peacetime posse. That's what they referred to themselves. They were just a bunch of local yokels who called themselves a posse in support of the sheriff. The Posse Comitatus is a ultra-right-wing hate group. They were the forerunners of the groups that later became the militias in the late 80s and early 90s. The Posse Comitatus basically believe in local government only, and the local government they believe in is at the county level. They don't believe in any form of government beyond the county level. So therefore, they do not recognize federal government. They do not recognize city government, only the county sheriff level. And if the sheriff does not abide by what they feel is right, then they feel like they have the authority to take down the sheriff. And the Posse Comitatus was very strong in Colorado Springs. I used to personally have dealings with Posse Comitatus members where I would stop them for a speeding violation, for example, in our main street, and request a license and registration, they would refuse to provide me with that, telling me that I had no authority over them because I was not a county sheriff's deputy. Therefore, they did not have to provide me with a license and registration, and they did not have to obey any orders or directives that I gave them. And we encountered posse comitatus members all the time that approach us that way. I won't get into with your listeners as to what I was, how I responded and how other officers responded to the posse members, but the bottom line is they obeyed our orders and ended up locked up in jail one way or the other.
With the Klan merging with the posse comitatus, what was that like, and how concerning, how concerned were people around that? Well, and I'm asking this, in the backdrop because what we're talking about too is at this time the Klan had taken on a new persona, and perhaps you can elaborate on that before even answering the question, which was the Klan was basically putting away their hoods and becoming more media savvy and becoming a friendly type of entity, even though they harbored a lot of this sort of racial hatred.
The irony to the Klan that I was dealing with, the David Duke faction of the Klan, was that David Duke was referred to by the press as the new face of the Ku Klux Klan. He never wore a hood in public, only in private ceremonial purposes. He never used the N-word in public. However, in private conversations with David Duke, he and I threw the N-word around like a baseball. So we chatted and threw the N-word around all the time. In fact, if your listeners are remember the old TV show Roots about Alex Haley, the late Alex Haley, finding his roots, tracing his roots back to Africa, Duke liked to joke that it was called Weeds. That's how he referred to this TV show. He referred to it as Weeds, and he always used it as a punchline in some of his talks.
Wow.
But he got a kick out of that and would talk to me on the phone about the TV show Weeds and laugh about it and throw the N-word around, and we both would get good chuckles out of that. Remember, I was playing a role. Undercover right. is nothing but acting. So I was acting with him and playing the white racist role with him. And Duke was the new face of the Klan in that he was very articulate, wore a three-piece suit, very well-groomed. He was the kind of gentleman, if you will, and I use the term loosely, but he was the kind of gentleman who a mother would want their daughter to come home with and take to the prom. That's how he presented himself. He was a hell of a debater, held a master's degree in political science from Louisiana State University, and he was not your stereotypical Klansman like everybody thinks in terms of the image you see portrayed in movies and TV shows and such. So one of the angles that David Duke was pushing at that time was to avoid confrontations in public, avoid using the N-word, don't wear your hood in public if you have to, and get politically involved. He even cited, and Fred Wilkins, the fireman, the Colorado Grand Dragon, as well as Ken O'Dell, the local organizer who I initiated this investigation with, they even cited Dr. King and the civil rights movement, the angle that they were taking in that register more white people who think the way we think, register them to vote so we can impact the political process and change the movement the way we want it to be changed. They were citing Dr. King's efforts for their political right. purpose. So this was the angle that they were going at. They were trying to form a new political movement via the ballot box.
Do you think that ever took wind when we look at some of the racial animosity that we see today? And again, I started off by talking about the report that just came out about the military being infiltrated, and you know, all these Klan men are now returning home, having military training, having served 3 and 4 terms. Is, you know, what's your thoughts about that in 2014? One would think that with these investigations that with quote unquote enlightened times, things would have changed, but in many ways they seem like they've gotten worse.
I am as concerned about the Klansmen in the military as I am concerned about street gang members in the military who have returned home and now have the tactical training to return to the hood and go about their gang activities, fighting for the blue and the red and whatever other color scheme they're claiming. It's a frightening prospect, and yet it's happening all the time and has been happening. So I hold both of those issues. I have deep concern for both of those issues, be they black or white.
Well, one of the things that we know over the years is that as these white supremacist groups have emerged, that, you know, early on, the formation of gangs, black gangs in particular, was to deal with them. And even when you look at some of the military stuff, that, you know, we're talking about the infiltration of the Klan in the military when you first investigated them. You know, you didn't have that situation, people posseed up until much later, and it was usually in response. That leads to the question of why weren't these groups ever really eradicated, not to equate the street gang with the Klansmen, because the Klan gang has been around for a very long time. And as you pointed out in your book, there were periods in history where, you know, they were the mayors and senators and what have you. You don't have a Crip in the blood that's the senator or the mayor of a city, but you did with Klans people. And even now, today, I'm looking at an article that has a sheriff deputy in L.A. that's talking about how that department has been overrun with Klan members, and that's, you know, raising a fuss now. So with that institution, terrorist institution, how do we deal with that, and to what extent do you feel that from the time that you were investigating them to now, under somebody who had this charismatic leadership like a Duke, how widespread do you think that mission that he undertook was able to really unfold?
Well, let's approach it. Let's approach that question from this angle, David. In terms of the street gang aspect of it, ironically, a lot of street gangs, black street gangs, formed for idealistic reasons. I could take that even further and say that a lot of gangs, period, including the Italian mafia, they formed for idealistic reasons to preserve the cause of their particular ethnic group.
Right.
They formed for noble purposes, in other words. The problem with them is that even though they formed for noble purposes, they started preying on their own people and committing crimes against their own people, and thus, in committing crimes against their own people, they started preying on their own people and exploiting their own people. That's where the negativity comes in, where ethnic street gangs are concerned. The Klan, on the other hand, had one purpose and one purpose in mind only, and that was to exploit the minority group in which they had issues with. And in the history of the Klan, that minority group always began with blacks, Jews, in the early 20th century, Catholics were included. And if you fast forward into the 20th century, they later included whatever minority group came along over time. The Irish Americans, fast forward into the post-Vietnam era, and when we started accepting Vietnamese refugees, they started trying to exploit them because there were so many of them, especially down in the Texas Gulf area. So the Ku Klux Klan has always been about exploiting minority groups, never about trying to help anybody, and it's always been about promoting the white race. In terms of the history of the Ku Klux Klan and its exploitation, the history of the Klan, in my book, I point out that during, in terms of Colorado, where I worked, during the 1920s, early 30s, the Ku Klux Klan dominated Colorado politics. When I talk about David Duke wanting to change the Klan into a political party, he was basically going backwards in time. The Klan in the 20s in Colorado, they dominated the political agenda in Colorado. And ironically, I would point out to your leader, your listeners, the Ku Klux Klan has always traditionally been sympathetic to the Republican Party, the conservative agenda of our nation. In the 20s, the Ku Klux Klan was dominated Republican Party politics in Colorado. They held the governor's office. They held the entire state legislative body. They controlled the U.S. Congressional delegation. They controlled the Denver Police Department in terms of the chief. He was important. He in fact was appointed or was named by the Grand Wizard of the Klan and thus appointed chief by the mayor, who was appointed or who got the support of the Klan. That mayor later became governor. Your listeners may not know this, but in my book I point out that that mayor later became governor. His name was Benjamin Stapleton. They are familiar with the name Stapleton because they used to fly into Stapleton Airport before it was torn down and became Denver International Airport. But they were flying into an airport that honored a Ku Klux Klansman. But during that period of time, the Klan dominated Colorado politics. They dominated it so much, it was probably the most dominated Klan state outside of the Deep South. And it was dominated so much that reporters stopped spelling it with a C and started spelling it with a capital K.
Wow. If you just tune in, that's the voice of Sergeant Ron Stallworth talking about his book, Black Klansman. He's an African-American man who was able to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan. Fascinating story. And, you know, we have talked to you before about it, but now you have the book. You know, we're running out of time, but, you know, one of the highlights of that book was that as you were an undercover member, in your official capacity where you went undercover, you were assigned to bodyguard David Duke when he came to Colorado, and that caused some problems when you took pictures with him when he didn't want to have that happen, and you almost wound up arresting him. What was that like? And I'm surprised he didn't catch your voice then, or did you talk to him in your capacity as an official uniformed officer who had to bodyguard him when he came to Colorado?
Yes, we were getting death threats against David Duke, and my chief, on the morning he arrived in town for a publicity blitz, my chief assigned me to be his bodyguard. Part of my capacity as an intelligence officer, one of our duties was VIP protection. We routinely bodyguarded VIPs, the president, vice president, people like that. And my chief gave David Duke VIP status for the simple reason that because of his capacity as the Grand Wizard and the death threats he was given, my chief did not want anything to happen to him in the city. So he gave him VIP classification and told me to be his bodyguard while he was in town for about 4 hours, 5 hours or so. And even though I argued against it based on the investigation, Chuck, the white Ron Stallworth, was with him along with another undercover officer I had gotten placed into the group. But the chief insisted that I be there as his bodyguard. So I went to the restaurant where they were hosting this meeting. There was about 20 Klansmen. Half of them had their wives present. This was an important event for this group. It would be like us attending a dinner with Obama and Mrs. Obama in their minds. And I went to him. I introduced myself to him. I shook his hand. He gave me the Klan handshake. He didn't know that I recognized it as such, but he gave me the Klan handshake. And I told him I did not agree with his politics and his philosophy, but I would do my professional best to ensure his safety while he was in my city. He thanked
me. He didn't recognize your voice from all the conversations on the phone?
I'll take that even further, Davey. Standing next to him was Fred Wilkins, the Colorado Grand Dragon, the fireman, and standing next to him was Ken O'Dell, the local organizer. They all three were standing right next to each other when I was talking to David Duke. And no, none of them caught my voice. That was my moment of apprehension, why I didn't want to be in this position in the first place, because I knew I would have to communicate with them. But I went there, and my identity, my undercover role, everything was secure. I had them so convinced of my role as a white racist that they never once picked up on the fact that they were talking to the guy who was talking to them on the phone, pretending to be one of them. They never picked up on it. And that's the irony to this investigation.
Go ahead. You were going to say?
David Duke, his Grand Dragon, and the local chapter leader were all made complete fools of by a black man who they routinely, in their theoretical assessment of blacks and minorities, they routinely referred to us as apes, having the mentality of apes. I routinely, this ape, so to speak, routinely made a fool of them, and that's the irony to this whole thing. They weren't as smart as they thought they were.
We're talking with Ron Starworth. As we wrap up, in the book, you know, shortly after, you know, the investigation ends, what was the conclusion and why were you ordered to destroy those papers? You kept them anyway, which is the basis for the book. So you were able to see the documents and all that. But why did they want to kind of erase that from history?
My chief was fairly new to the job. I think he'd been a chief for 2 years. He had previously been the lieutenant in charge of public relations department. He was very public relations conscious. And the Ku Klux Klan, the local chapter leader, kept pushing, believe it or not, he wanted Ron Stallworth to assume leadership of the Colorado Springs chapter of the KKK because in his assessment, Ron Stallworth was a, quote, loyal and dedicated Klansman. And he, as a military man, had to leave. He was getting out of the Army, and he wanted a local person, a local Colorado Springs resident, to assume leadership to maintain a sense of stability. And he kept pushing for Ron Stallworth to become his successor, in spite of my protestations and in spite of Chuck, the white Ron Stallworth, telling him the same. And every time I tried to say no, he kept insisting. Chuck would say no, he kept insisting. So finally, I went to the chief and said, "Chief, this guy is insisting and he won't take no for an answer. He wants Ron Stallworth to become the leader of the KKK." And the chief said, "I want you to shut the investigation down now. I want you to shut the undercover phone line down, change the P.O. box number. Don't answer any more phone calls. Don't go to any more meetings. I want Ron Stallworth, Black Klansman, to disappear." And that's how the investigation ended. And the chief then said, "I want you to destroy all files. I don't want any record or any reference to us having undercover cops into the Klan." This was an intelligence investigation, not a criminal investigation. So there was no arrest made. We were gathering information, hopefully that would lead to an arrest. They were talking about bombing gay bars. They were talking about stealing automatic weapons from Fort Carson. They were talking about uniting with other right-wing racist hate groups in Colorado. This is what we were hoping to accomplish, was following this trail. Why I wanted the investigation to go on was I had a pathway, if you will, to, if I had been able to assume the leadership, by I meant Chuck and I, if I had been able to assume the leadership of the Colorado Springs chapter, we could have penetrated the Colorado hate movement to a degree that nobody had ever penetrated before in law enforcement, and there's no telling how far up the chain, food chain, we could have gone. And I argued with my chief, but he was insistent that the investigation shut down and that the files be destroyed because he was worried about the public finding out that we had officers undercover into the KK. So when he insisted that the files be destroyed, I saluted, came back to my office angrily, along with my sergeant, who disagreed with him. And in the presence of my sergeant, I shredded one report here, one report there. And when the sergeant left the office and I was left alone, I grabbed the files and I walked out of the office with those files, and I've had them with me for the past 35 years, and that's the basis of which I wrote my book. So I wrote that book directly from the police files, I could have lost my job, lost my career if that had been discovered, and it's a decision I've never regretted.
Ron Starworth, it's a pleasure talking with you. The name of the book, Black Klansman.
And I like
to look out for it.
They can be purchased at Amazon.com.
There you have it. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
See, unlike America would have us believe, the greatest problem confronting this country today is not pollution and bad breath. It's black people. It's black people. See, that's just one of the big lies that America tells you and that you go for because you chumps. You go for it. One of the lies that we tell ourselves is that we're making progress. But here is chairs empty. We're not making progress. We tend to equate progress with concessions. We can no longer make that mistake.
Yeah, this is Brothers Keeper from Memphis, Tennessee. What's going on? What's going on? And we always listening to Brother David D on Hard Knock Radio.
Yeah.
Yes, the revolution will not be televised.
It is Hard Knock Radio, David D hanging out with you this afternoon. And as our eyes and ears continue to be focused on what is taking place, the massacre, the genocide in Gaza, many are coming to the conclusion that Israel is fighting this on several fronts. First, there is the what is taking place on the ground with troops massacring people, bombs being dropped, that sort of thing. But we also see the oppression and repression taking place in other arenas, in particular the political, as well as the social, and even in the entertainment arenas, where anybody who speaks out against Israel is considered anti-Semitic, or they are demonized, or they're made to fear that they won't have employment, or they'll be blacklisted. Somebody who's covering this and getting ready to put out an explosive column tomorrow for the Black Agenda Report is Bruce Dixon. Bruce, how are you?
I'm doing better than a whole lot of folks, Davey. How about yourself?
Good. You are talking about this silencing that goes on with respect to anybody speaking out about what is going on, the atrocities in Gaza, and if they don't carry the party line, then there's fear of some sort of retribution. But you really bring a lot of heat to the black political leaders who you say are complicit in this and have, in many ways, literally sold their souls. Can you talk about what you're unearthing in your column?
Well, sometimes, Davey, sometimes the silence is the loudest noise in the room. And, you know, what we've been treated to, what black people have been treated to, is the deafening silence of our so-called black leadership on what's happening in Palestine, in Israel-Palestine right now. As of Tuesday morning, Democracy Now! Says that we've got over 600 dead in Gaza and 25 or 30 Israeli dead. And, you know, that's significant. All this is happening on the dime of the U.S. taxpayers, and the U.S. is the principal financier and armorer of Israel. And not only is our black political class silent on the massacre that's underway now and on the occupation in general, but our black misleadership class is silent on the fact that Israel is an ethnocracy. What do I mean by an ethnocracy? An ethnocracy is a society where a certain group of people, based on their ethnicity, have privileges over every other group of people. And given the fact that our black misleadership class celebrates its ties to the freedom movement and the heritage of Dr. King and all the freedom fighters that we generated over the last several generations, it's particularly incongruous that they, with their silence and sometimes with their active spoken words and acts, seem to support exactly the opposite of that in Israel-Palestine. And it seems that they are, and even if George Bush and Dick Cheney were still president and vice president, a few of them might actually speak out and remind us of the humanity of the Palestinian people. And, you know, but with a Democrat in the White House and a black Democrat at that, they're showing who their real masters are, and they're absolutely silent. And that silence is deafening.
I started off by saying that there is a battle being front on many, many levels. And I alluded to the fact that there is a political and sometimes a social and economic price to be paid if you speak out against Israel. Many people at this station have been labeled anti-Semitic if you're pro-Palestinian. We've seen artists like Rihanna and sports figure Dwight Howard being pressured to take back their tweets where they said Free Palestine. We've seen others remain
even
silent.
Even Stoudemire, who identifies as a Jew himself.
Right.
You know, so
we've seen others, you know, be very careful about how they speak because they fear that there would be consequence. And we know that Cynthia McKinney, who spoke out in favor of the Palestinians, was politically challenged with a lot of money coming in from all over the world and into her opponent's coffers, who would take a pro-Israel stance versus a pro-Palestinian stance. With that type of reality, should we expect those who are elected officials to not be silent, or is there something else going on?
Well, what we should demand is for leaders to lead. If our black elected officials and our black political class and our black preachers and our black leading business people are leaders, then why aren't they leading on this? Why are they following? And what are they following? We should really take the reins out of their hands and be participating as a people and as communities in the BDS movement, the global movement to boycott, to divest from, and to sanction the apartheid Israeli state. And it is an apartheid state. And that's what makes the silence of black leadership so odious, that they celebrate their victory over apartheid in South Africa and their victory over Jim Crow apartheid on this continent, but they are speechless when it comes to apartheid backed by U.S. dollars in Israel-Palestine. The most they'll do is talk about a two-state solution, but a two-state solution is obviously impossible and impractical. There is only one state. And the question now is going to be, will that be a state for all the people who live there, or will it be a state just for one ethnicity? And our black leadership need to have a stand on that. And if they're not going to have a stand on it, then we need to stand on it.
We had a former political prisoner and Black Panther BLA member, Daruba Bin Wahad, on yesterday, and he was talking about the black freedom movement had always supported and had strong ties with Palestinians. And, you know, he talked about folks who went over, supported, et cetera, et cetera. What has happened over the years that we see this shift from being actively supporting to this silence? Is it a payoff? Is it the fear? Again, I come back to that question. Or is it, you know, ideology changing? Have people in positions of influence and power, are they just more conservative now?
It is a profound ideological change on the part of the people who we imagine to be our leaders. The people who we imagine to be our leaders are really more concerned with their next boat payment and their next condo payment. They're more concerned with their own careers than they are with right and wrong. The people who ran the freedom movement back 45 years ago were not especially concerned about whether they were going to get tenure or not. They were not exactly concerned about their next boat payment, okay, or their next condo payment. So they were not operating under the kinds of constraints that people like Al Sharpton are operating under, that people like Rainbow Push and the NAACP. Did you know, I'm sure you knew, but did your listeners know that the NAACP held its 2014 annual convention in Las Vegas and just wrapped up on Sunday? They had a four-day convention while the troops were massing outside Gaza and while the bombs were raining. And you did not hear one word from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Now, the Palestinians in Palestine supported our struggle. They supported our struggle, and they looked to us for the longest, you know, for support and for examples of what they might do and how they might do it, and examples of standing up to injustice and to empire. And way our leadership is repaying them is shameful. We should hang our heads in shame. We really should. And the NAACP should hang its heads in shame. Yesterday was Monday. Have you heard Moral Monday make a statement about the situation in Gaza, about occupation? You will never hear Moral Monday say this, because or at least I don't think you will, because Moral Monday only brands as immoral things that Republicans do. Moral Monday doesn't believe that Democrats can be immoral, and never criticizes anything Democrats do. It's not just Gaza. Moral Monday doesn't criticize gentrification. Moral Monday doesn't criticize the war budget. This is the state of black leadership that we have. It's really subservient to the donors to our large organizations and to the Democratic administration in the White House.
My last question, and I want to remind people, your column that will be focusing on this will be out tomorrow on blackagendareport.com, and it could read your breakdown of this. I know with 30 seconds or less, I can't help but make the connection to this silence with the type of silence and complicity we found with many of these black elected officials who sided with the telecom companies when millions of people have been demanding that we protect net neutrality. This group of people, more than any other group in Congress, has supported the telecom. So do you make a connection to that? Is this a pay-for-play type of leadership we have now, or just something else going on?
That's exactly what it was. The last day of the last originally scheduled day of comments, the NAACP issued a statement against network neutrality, and on behalf of the telecom's ability to divide up the internet like it's cable TV and erect toll booths everywhere. So this is the kind of black leadership we have. So that ought to tell you it's really time for something new.
Bruce Dixon, thank you so much. We'll look out for the Black Agenda Report column. Bruce, of course, and Glenn Ford, his partner, are usually heard on our airwaves with their commentary. It's good to have you live this afternoon.
Thanks for inviting me, Davey.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Thank you. listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Coming this Monday, June 15th at 3 p.m., the Monday Sampler once again presents Nigel Bruce as Dr. John Watson.
Began on a winter's night in 1896.